So by putting the pieces together, as we consider what God has said, and we put it into to context, the first thing that we learn is that Damascus is revolting, it is corrupt, and it's going to be removed from among inhabited cities. And the city itself shall become a twisted and tangled heap of rubble. Then God said, abandoned and forsaken will be the inhabited regions of Aroer, which can speak of the outcasts, the refugees in particular, in Lebanon and also in Jordan. He says there will be roaming animals fighting in militant militias, and then there will be no one left to terrorize. So the fortified place will cease to exist. This is speaking now of Damascus. It's going to cease to exist. The government in Syria is going to fall because of Ephraim, on account of Ephraim. Ephraim is a reference to the northern kingdom. So this would be the part of Israel that is north of Jerusalem. So you look at Israel and you see it as two entities, really. Ephraim is the northern kingdom. It's home to 10 of the 12 tribes. And then Yehuda, with the capital of Jerusalem, is home to two of the 12 tribes. And it's the area surrounding Jerusalem, whereby the area that's principally north, but also elsewhere, but principally north of that, would be the northern kingdom. And it's that's the area that's the most vulnerable right now to the jihadist in Syria, to the jihadist in Lebanon. And you know, if you think about the jihadists, too, in Lebanon, you come to realize that they are principally now Hezbollah. They're very well armed. And if the Sunni Mujahideen, as the prophecy suggests, prevail against the Shiites, then Israel's most aggressive foe, Hezbollah, in Lebanon, will be brought down. And that would be very good news for Ephraim, for the northern kingdom. But the fortified places that are going to cease to exist includes here the government, the kingdom, the empire, the authority of Damascus. So the government out of Damascus, which is the Assad regime, according to this prophecy, is going to fall. Assad's going to lose. The Shiites are going to lose, including the remnant of what's left of Syria. So not only is the government out of Damascus going to fall, which would be the Assad government, but Syria as a nation is going to fail. Again, this is exactly what we are seeing play out. And God says that the government of Syria is going to fall, as is Damascus, for being similarly vehement and burdensome. This is kabood, fanatical and onerous. While abundantly wealthy and overly self-glorifying, they are hardened and grievous, ignorant and dim-witted, hard-headed and stupid, enraged and troublesome. Now, with all of that being said, God still wants to make it clear that even though all of these places are going to be forsaken, abandoned, deserted, a heap of rubble, unpopulated, depopulated, I should probably say. He says the children of Yisrael, Bene Yisrael, shall continue to exist. Now, he's not saying that here the nation of Israel is going to, be unscathed by this. He just says the children of Israel. Doesn't name how many of them, but the children of Israel, Bene Yisrael, shall continue to exist, will endure, prophetically declares Yahweh. So if the goal of the Sunni Mujahideen and if the goal of the Shiite Hezbollah is to destroy Israel, they're going to fail. But that's not going to say that there isn't going to be an enormous amount of carnage. Now, this previous passage, 17:3, is a challenge to translate because some of the terms deployed within it have diverse connotations. For example, kabood. Kabood can be good or bad. depending on the context. In this case, since Yahweh is speaking about the utter destruction of Damascus and the implications associated with the demise of the Syrian government and of the outcasts and refugees being azab, which is to be damned, the most rational approach is to consider the negative aspects of Kabod. So rather than rendering it significant and glorious, as it can be rendered in a different context, a more fitting depiction can be advanced by examining the etymological roots Kabod and Kobed. They suggest that these Islamic nations, and Syria in particular, of surrounding Israel will cease to exist because these Muslims are vehement in their rage. They're onerous and burdensome in their abuse. They're hard-headed and grievous in their thinking. They're ignorant and dim-witted in their beliefs. Foolish as a nation, and thus enraged and troublesome. How does that strike you, Glenn? Does that seem like an apt portrayal of the belligerents in the Syrian war?
Well, it seems like an apt description of much of the human race at this juncture, but...
Okay, you got me there.
Yeah, I've got to go check out CNN. Apparently, in another ferocious wave of sanctions, Julia Tymoshenko and Obama have agreed to issue parking tickets to any and all tanks, trucks, and armored personnel carriers in the Crimea.
Oh, my goodness. I can imagine if you go up to a tank and you put a parking ticket on a tank, you have dissuaded that crew. There is no chance that they'll remain there.
And I'm being facetious once again, of course.
Yeah.
So, but I do have to go. But
okay.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Glenn.
Have a good day.
Yeah. Thank you, Glenn. It is true that much of the world is foolish. Much of the world is dim-witted in their beliefs. Much of the world is troublesome to God. And what we're witnessing in terms of the rhetoric out of Washington, we have become vehement in our rage. We are abusive. We're ignorant in our thinking. This is true of most of humanity today, but it is especially true of Muslims. And you don't have to be pejorative to come to that conclusion. You know, just look at the pictures of the Mujahideen, of the jihadists, of the Muslims who protest. You can see it in their eyes, their faces while they scream enraged slogans. While they are responsible for 99% of the world's terrorist acts. It's pervasive. And, you know, this morning I was having a conversation with my wife. We were talking, she was reading a book about the abuse of women in the Mormon Church and the Church of Latter-day Saints. And talking about just how despicable that religion is. Yes, and particularly in his treatment of women. You know, we expanded that to say, well, you know, that there's 750 Muslim women that have even fewer rights and are just treated even more abusively than in Mormonism. And that, you know, this is pervasive in the nature of religion. And the world's filled with idiotic religions. And we started listing them in terms of most idiotic to slightly less idiotic, and it's a long list of how stupid religions are, how dim-witted you have to be to place your faith in them. Whether it's Scientology or Islam or Mormonism or Roman Catholicism, you just have to either be ignorant or irrational to believe the rhetoric of any of these. And God, that's how he views us. You know, God gave us his instructions. He told us who he is. He very clearly revealed his covenant, told us how to participate in it, told us what the benefits were going to be, provided guidance for living to go from this world to his. And the vast preponderance of people, 99.999% of people have chosen to completely disregard everything he said. In fact, most despise it and have chosen instead to believe some of the most dim-witted, foolish, completely moronic religions. I mean, look at Christianity, just mainstream Christianity. God died. Yeah, the God of Christianity died. What good is a God you can kill? And the religion then is mirrors the death and resurrection cults of all of the sons of pagan religions of old. Celebrates the same holidays. You know, how many lies does a religion have to foist on the unsuspecting before the unsuspecting finally says, you know, you can't fool me with that anymore? Well, I can tell you that having compiled what is perhaps the best documented, most comprehensive, chronological presentation of Islam's five oldest scriptural sources and Prophet of Doom, that Islam, and I don't say this as an opinion, but as a conclusion, is among, if not the single dumbest, most utterly foolish major religion. Now, it's true that Christianity is filled with all sorts of idiotic notions, from their Trinity to Easter to bodily resurrection to God dying to God being normal and nameless and being called a Lord, which is incompatible with the Father and covenant, with the notion that a man who admitted to being demon-possessed and insane wrote half the Christian New Testament, and he claims to be authorized to demean everything that God previously said and come up with an entirely different plan. Yeah, it's pretty stupid. But Islam is dumber still. The Quran is, by any reasonable standard, the worst book ever written. It's neither chronological nor contextual. It is filled with a never-ending argument between Muhammad and those who knew him best, who claimed that Muhammad was a charlatan. It transitions from there to being an overt attack on God's chosen people, the Jews. The only thing that's remotely credible are the Talmud stories that Muhammad bought from rabbis in Yathrib, today's Medina. But then Muhammad declares war on them. He claims then that his Quran is a confirmation of the Torah when it is the antithesis of the Torah. They're absolute opposites. He claims that God wants you to kill, and that unless you are willing to kill for him, you have no opportunity to get his great reward, which is virgins in paradise. Yeah, you have to be stupid to be a Muslim. The names that were listed in this prophecy are also revealing. Dramesk is transliterated Damascus. And it is the current focus, as you know, of Islam's intolerance. Sunni jihadist arms with American weapons are murdering, raping, and robbing tens of thousands of Shiites and Christians, while opposing Shia troops and militants are responding in kind, albeit they are using Russian and Iranian arms. Not only be told by God that this Islamic infighting will reduce the city to rubble, the city's name describes a weeping sore where there are tears of sorrow over corpses covered in dung. It's a place where the people are silenced. There's also a couple of other connotations that I wouldn't want you to miss. Dam is the Hebrew word for blood. Dramesk means to build a bag or a sack. And so it is literally a sack of blood is how God views and has named this place. Aurora in the Isnext, and we have talked about it. It has many interesting connotations. The Cyprus speaks of Lebanon. Its Ammon reference is to Jordan. It speaks of outcasts who are refugees. So this would be the so-called Palestinian terrorists, those loyal to Hamas and the PLO. Its root means wild ass, which is a reference to Muslims through Ishmael. And we learn that they will be deserted and forsaken. These places will be abandoned apart from roaming animals who will comprise Islamic militias. And even for them, eventually there will be no longer any civilians left to terrorize. Ephraim was the next name in the list that is interesting. Yahweh deploys it to speak of a divided Yisrael, of the region initially estranged from him because they forsook the covenant. favoring the kind of international military alliances that have been so devastating for humankind. The Northern Kingdom was destroyed by Assyria within a generation of its formation, and thereby serves as an example of how not to behave. You know, that didn't even survive for more than a generation, and it was gone because it never aligned itself with Yahweh, never trusted him, never engaged in the things that God had hoped they would do. It became a cesspool for an amalgamation of religion, kind of like Christianity is. Christianity is a cesspool for amalgamated religion. It takes a little bit from every religion in the world. The same was true with the Northern Kingdom. They began that process. And because of that, they didn't survive very long. They were hauled off into slavery. It's why they say that there's the 10 lost tribes of Israel. That's what they're talking about. They were hauled off, brutalized by the Assyrians. Today's northern Iran and Iraq. The men were hauled off with fish hooks in their noses. The women were raped. They were not just enslaved, but brutalized. Man is a savage animal. So Ephraim is speaks of a divided Israel, of the northern kingdom, of that which is not Yehudah, transliterated Judah. It speaks of that which is not influenced by Jerusalem. So Yahweh has promised to reconcile Yisrael with Yehudah, and to do that, then Ephraim has to be reunited with Yehudah. So God is saying that Ephraim is going to, there's going to be a remnant. By spared, that's maybe too strong a statement. You know, the children of Israel are going to survive. Not intact, but a remnant of them is going to survive, because collectively Ephraim and Yehudah and a united Israel is what greets Yahweh upon his return. When the covenant is finally renewed, it is renewed with Yisrael and with Yehudah. In this case, Yisrael representing Ephraim, the northern kingdom, which were divided 2,500 years ago or more, and will be reunified, but in their love of Yahweh's name, an appreciation of his Torah, and by engaging in his covenant. Gradually, the 10 tribes comprising Ephraim, which have been scattered in Assyria, today's Iran, Iraq, and Syria, will end their open rebellion against Yahweh. The long divorce, which is proclaimed in Hosea, will soon be over. The day of reconciliation, Yom Kippurim, in year 6000 Yah, which is sunset on October 2nd, 2033. This is when it's all going to take place, and that date is imminent. We are just, 14, 15 years away. This prophecy not only says that the government out of Damascus is going to fall, but so will Aram, which is Syria. And it could have been just rendered Syria, so long as everyone realizes what Aram means, and that Syria means much more to the Islamic combatants fighting there than the current national boundaries. The capital of the Islamic world, after Sunnis bludgeoned Shia Muslims into submission in the 8th century, was Damascus. And their Sham, Syria, represented the entire region, including today's Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Jordan, Iran, and Iraq. It was from Damascus that this unified Islamic caliphate ruthlessly ruled much of the world, from Spain and northern Africa to India and everything in between. Most of the Sunni jihadists fighting in Syria are committed to the same result, a unified base from which they want to conquer the rest of the world. Now, when you're aiding and abetting the Sunni rebels in Syria, understand that is their goal, is to reestablish the caliphate under Sunni Islam, have it control the world from Damascus. It will be the stepping off place to conquer every place on earth. That's why we ought not be on that side I'm not saying that the Assad side is wonderful. It isn't. It's horrible. But it is actually better than the side America is backing. Most of the Sunni jihadists fighting in Syria are committed to this result, a unified base from which they want to conquer the rest of the world, so that every soul surrenders to Allah. This is the goal. It's the catalyst for all Islamic conquest, the throttle for Islamic rage. It's the sandbox for Islamic jihadists to prove themselves worthy of Allah's paradise. It's the fulcrum upon which Sunni Islam will prevail over the rival Shia. And it's the epicenter of the next world war, with alliances divided between the belligerents. Every Muslim within greater Assyria will suffer because they are universally fanatical and onerous, ignorant and enraged, and they will die, massacring one another so that Israel may live. It would be easy to assume that Yahweh is somehow encouraging these religious zealots to harm themselves for the sake of his children, but that is not the case. At this point, with Muslims killing Muslims, Yahweh is simply reporting what he has witnessed. That is not to say that God won't intervene. He will, but only when the survival of Israel is at stake. There is a myth that is very active in religious circles, both in Islamic as well as in Christian religious circles. In fact, it's probably embraced by the majority of Muslims and Christians, that God is a micromanager, that he has his hand in everything, that whoever prevails and or loses in a war was made to do so by the God, that the God chooses who lives and who dies, that the God manages and manipulates everything, and that they spend their time in prayer encouraging their God to manipulate things in their favors. And therefore, this is naturally expanded to be that when a disaster strikes, that it was an act of God. That when a people are pummeled into submission, that it was God judging them. Jerry Falwell, following 9/11. Pointed his finger at the TV cameras and shook his finger and said, this happened because God is judging the, and he had a whole host of things, the gay and lesbian agenda, the civil rights advocates, the secular government, and that God is judging us because of these things. And as if God flew those planes into those buildings. It is pervasive in the religion. And Muslims constantly saying, you know, Allah willing, we'll bring them down. We'll kill them. Allahu Akbar. Well, that isn't the nature of God. The world's going to devolve and it's going to be hell. But God's not doing it. Man is. It's religion and politics and militarism and jaundiced economic schemes all coming together without constraint to make life on this planet miserable. That's why God doesn't allow religion and politics, patriotism and militarism into heaven. He's not going to tolerate it. It's an absolute emphatic no. If you want to embrace those things, that's your choice. You're just not going to heaven. You're not going to be part of his family. We are bringing these vicious results upon ourselves. God is merely allowing us to be miserable, to be vicious, up to the point that the very fate of Israel and the children of Israel are at stake, and then he's going to step in, but only at the last minute. Now, since it's vitally important, and since Yahweh uses prophecy to prove that he is God and that he inspired this testimony, let's be perfectly clear. This prophetic portrayal specifically states that the government, the mamlaka, the kingdom, the authority, the people ruled under the monarchy out of men, Damascus, including the remnant, the remaining portion, the Sa'ar, of Aram, which is Syria, will cease to exist. Sabbath. We can therefore conclude that Sunni jihadists will eventually prevail bringing down the Iranian-backed Shia government of Syria. But in the process, these Islamic terrorists won't conquer Syria. They're going to ruin it. They're not going to conquer Damascus. They're going to destroy it. They aren't going to lord over the civilian population of that country. They're going to decimate it. That's what's going to happen. This is a bit surprising, currently, although ultimately inevitable. Assad has the upper hand at this point, 3 years into the conflict. Sunni jihadists have started killing one another. They are losing their grip on cities previously captured. And Russia has effectively prevented American intervention on behalf of the rebels. But the numbers tell a very different story. And the numbers always add up. Sunni Muslims outnumber Shiites more than 2-1 in the Middle East and 4-1 worldwide. And Sunnis, which receive American weapons, are vastly better armed. The 50 Sunni-majority Islamic nations spend well over $150 billion annually on their militaries, with Saudi Arabia leading that charge at $57 billion a year. Excuse me, the four Shiite-majority countries, Iran, Iraq, Azerbaijan, and Bahrain, devote less than $15 billion annually to their war preparations, with Iran and Iraq each devoting $6 billion to their military forces a year. Syria is a bit of an anomaly because its $2 billion military expenditures are on behalf of Shia Islam in a majority Sunni nation. So collectively, this means that in this proxy war, the Shiites are outmanned 4-1 and they're outgunned 10-1. The math will ultimately catch up with them, as it did the rebels during the American Civil War. And speaking of America, the United States outspends Russia and China combined by more than 2-1 militarily. So forgetting for a moment that the European Union is also allied with the Sunni rebels, America squanders $682 billion on its war machine, while just $256 billion is spent annually by Assad's allies, the combined forces of Russia and China. This is yet another indication that Yanawa's prediction will be proven correct. His promises are also reliable. He has made a solemn vow to reconcile his relationship with Yisrael and with Yehuda, those individuals who engage and endure with God. They will ultimately be brought together. And so God is telling us that there will be a surviving remnant of Yisrael, that there will be a surviving remnant of Ephraim, the northern kingdom, because ultimately in the last day, some 19 years from now, he will meet with them, and they will be reconciled in their relationship with him. He has vowed to accomplish this in his prophetic testimony. He vowed to accomplish this in his discussions all the way back with Abraham. So here's where we are so far. A prophetic pronouncement regarding Damascus. Behold, Damascus is revolting and corrupt and will be removed from among inhabited cities. It is degenerate and unrestrained and shall be abolished. And she shall actually and totally become a twisted and tangled heap of rubble, speaking of Damascus. The abandoned and forsaken, the estranged, deserted, destroyed, and damned will be the inhabited regions and populated cities of Aurora, the outcasts, the refugees in Jordan and Lebanon. For there will be roaming animals fighting in militant militias, failing miserably. But then there will be no one to terrorize. So the fortified place and defensive structures will cease to exist on account of the northern kingdom. along with the government out of Damascus, including the remnant of Syria, for being similarly vehement and burdensome, fanatical and onerous, dim-witted and enraged. The children of Yisrael, however, those individuals who engage and endure with God, shall actually continue to exist, prophetically declares Yahweh of the vast array of spiritual messengers and envoys. Now, for an alternative view, the King James Version renders the last verse, quote, "The fortress also shall cease from Ephraim, and the kingdom from Damascus, and the remnant of Syria, they shall be as the glory of the children of Israel, saith the Lord of hosts." This implies that the utter destruction of Syria, but also implies that the heap of twisted rubble that is Damascus will cause the Muslims who live there to become as glorious as the children of Israel. If nothing else, this affirms that the English Christians who wrote the King James Version don't hold Israel in very high regard. A program note here as we conclude our presentation on the prophecy of Yeshaya, Isaiah 17 and 18, is that this will be the last program that I do live here for a little over a week. I am going on vacation beginning early tomorrow morning. IQ Al-Rasuli is going to do all 3 hours tomorrow. IQ is the foremost expert on Islam. He's very well known to our listeners. He'll do a marvelous job tomorrow. Then we have four programs that have been prepared by James. Many of our listeners know JV. He co-hosts the Shabbat program with me on Fridays, and he has prepared at least one program. I think it's one and a half programs on circumcision. Now, circumcision is the primary fulcrum that divides Pauline doctrine and thus Christianity from Yahweh's Torah and thus his covenant. So it's a very important subject, and he has a comprehensive presentation of on circumcision, followed by programs where he is covering Passover, Pesach, and matzah on yeasted bread, because they will be celebrated quite soon after my return. I will do a show on Bukkurim, but he does have those four shows between those three topics. And then Larry, who is also well known to this audience, he calls in quite frequently, has the big booming voice, and has the great recall of Yahweh's testimony. And William, who is well known not only to our listeners on this program, but also to the Shabbat Sabbath program, as the man with the great resonance in his voice, a wonderful family man who has just done such a marvelous job of articulating the nature of Yahweh's role as the head of the covenant family, his father. One of my favorite people to listen to, in fact, two of my very favorite people, Larry and William, are trying to pre-record a what I hope will be three shows for everyone to listen to as they present principally how one comes out of Christianity and comes to understand and embrace the covenant, and how different Yahweh's testimony is from Christianity. They working together do a marvelous job in that regard. Then I will be back a week from next Tuesday after, as I say, a vacation with my family. So that's the program notes. Look forward to being back with you. I will check in if major events take place around the world, but I would really like to have some time just to enjoy my my wife and sons and daughter-in-law. Continuing with this prophecy, which, as I say, we will return to upon my return and conclude. There's a lot more to share with you on this particular prophecy of Yeshaya 17 and 18 that is not only germane to what's happening in Syria, but directly of the United States, so that we know where the world is going and how we're going to get there. It also covers the harvest that Christians refer to as the rapture. That's not God's term. His term is the It's teruah, which is a time where God's going to glean, which is a secondary harvest, a smaller secondary harvest, his troubadours, those who are proclaiming his message. And it's described in the midst of this, and its timing is disclosed in the midst of this. So there's a lot we can learn from this prophecy, and we'll return to it. And then after we have done that, as I promised, we're going to begin a long series on Paul, exposing why it is important for you to reject Paul's letters and to discard everything that he has to say. We will disclose how Yahweh himself has called Paul the plague of death. So there's a lot to do over the shows which will follow. Continuing in this, the New American Evangelical, or the American Evangelical Christians, as part of their New Living Translation, also strove to suggest that that Israel's former glory was would be inherited by them. Here's their rendering. So the fortified towns of Israel will also be destroyed, and the royal power of Damascus will end. All that remains of Syria will share the fate of Israel's departed glory. As the evangelical Christians want to position themselves as the beneficiaries of Yahweh's promises, so if Israel's can be destroyed and their glory is now gone, they view it as being given to themselves. They would be wrong. We'll return in a week.